She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. This show is sponsored by the Fairfax Companies, a leader in the business of sustainability and a regular supporter of Mrs. Green's mission and vision. Thank you, Fairfax Companies, for your support. Speaking of the business of sustainability, our guest today is about the epitome of sustainability in any way that I think you could possibly imagine or interpret that. And I mean it. His name is Cody Lundeen. Cody is an internationally recognized professional survival instructor with more than 25 years of hands-on teaching experience. His love of all things self-reliant began as a child with the influence of his homesteading grandparents. So fast forward to 1991, with an initial investment of $10, if my research is true, yes, $10, Cody founded the Aboriginal Living Skills School using the same passion, determination, and psychological stamina he used to overcome some personal challenges and heal his life. He is the best-selling author of two books on survival and preparedness, 98.6 Degree, The Art of Keeping Your Ass Alive, I think that's what it is. I think I put keep. It's Keeping Your Ass Alive, which I love, published in 2003. And When All Hell Breaks Loose, Stuff You Need to Survive When Disaster Strikes, that was published in 2006. Because of his truly unique abilities and experiences, Cody has been featured on just about every news media I could contemplate or find, including the Today Show, the Discovery Channel, History Channel, Dateline, NBC, CBS, USA Today, the New York Times, Playboy, Newsweek, among many other things, and now Mrs. Green's World. Welcome, Cody.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Yeah, there's a lot to cover, and I just want to make two short announcements, and then we'll be on with the show, and we'll be all about Cody Lundeen. We are very excited, Mrs. Green's World, to announce that our Sustainers Program to keep us alive and growing is very active. We would love for you to become an official supporter of Mrs. Green's World, and you can do this by just going to our website at mrsgreensworld.com and click on Mrs. Green's World Sustainer in the upper right-hand corner. There is an amount there for everyone to become an official member of our growing community of people who care about the planet, and we so hope that you will do just that. I'm also very excited to say that officially there's an app for that when talking about listening to our podcast. It's called Igloo Radio. And again, visit our homepage, click on download free mobile app, and you're there. It works for all mobile devices, and we're getting great feedback from friends, listeners all over the country about how easy it is. So if you don't get to tune into the show at noon on Saturday, the podcast is up almost within 24 hours, and you can hear people like Cody Lundeen and their interviews. So I have a long, long list of questions for Cody, because there is so much to learn from someone who really is creating a global, sustainable community of people who care about the planet. He has a true connection to the Earth, and because preserving our planet is what it seems to me that you have dedicated your life to, Cody. So I read lots and lots and lots. I have a friend, Mort King, who actually went on one of your excellent adventures and took my breath away on more than one occasion. So let's, if it's okay with you, let's start with the macro, which I call, what is your message for the planet? What does preservation of the planet mean to you? I believe the planet is at such great risk, and people like you, knowing that you're out there, calm me down. So what is your message for the planet, for the citizens of the planet?
Well, you're serious about macro, aren't you?
I am serious about macro. I usually start with the micro and build up, but you have a vision, and you've had it for a really long time, long before I did. So what are you thinking?
Well, you know, I've always been into sustainability, and that's kind of a variable definition, you know, with the green movement, whatever that really means. But what I've come to realize is a many-faceted outlook on, it's such a massive question you're asking, but really I think if people just are true to themselves and do whatever they can do to walk lighter on the planet, and I don't mean that in a foofy, hippie way, I just mean it in a common sense way. And what I mean by that is, like in your intro, I literally spent time with grandparents, like a lot of us did, that went through the Depression. And in this case, they were hardcore South Dakota farmers who, as little children, their parents actually used the Homestead Act of the 1800s. And I literally have pictures of my family standing in the South Dakota prairie in front of a sod home, quite literally. So I've kind of been grounded in that regarding the needs versus the wants.
Right.
And I think most Americans get things confused in that respect alone. So if you want a macro version of how to save the earth, people should fully recognize what their needs are from the wants, recognize there is a difference, and try to strive at least to have the needs met, and then hopefully some sustainable wants upon that.
And that answer is so content-rich. It's like, so in every area of how much room do you need for your house, how many outfits of clothing do you need? If you're Cody Lundin, you don't need, like, at least 5 pairs of shoes in black. That would be safe to say, right?
Yeah, and it is a multifaceted answer, but all of us have our hypocrisy that we need to do to function. In other words, I have a gas-guzzling 15-passenger E350 van from hell. It's jacked up, four-wheel drive, locking axles, etc. Because what I do is I take people into the backcountry. And I started with my little Jeep with no back seat. Then I started with a really old Suburban, you know, and used it for years. And then I worked my way up to this van. But what that's doing is allowing me to take more people out into the bush or wherever, because I do modern survival, primitive skills, and urban preparedness, and turn them on to maybe a more sustainable viewpoint. So how in the hell do you get sustainability in an E350 jacked up hyper monster van? You really don't. But it's the dichotomy that we're all facing trying to live in a modern world here about using the technology we have to further promote what's better for the planet. The solar panels are not necessarily kind to the environment,
right,
in how they're produced, right?
Right.
But they're causing me to have enough power here to be able to talk to you in the middle of nowhere. So I think it's important, and this is what turns a lot of people off on the so-called green movement, is this stinky hippie waving their hands, eating worms, saying, "You bastard, you're drinking coffee." You know, so there has to be some sort of balance and context to when we get into how we live our lives, what's important and what's not, and the realization that that varies by individual and by family and by county and by culture, etc. It's not this cookie-cutter bullshit of, "I'm green now." You know, it's basically being true to oneself in motive and intention. And everyone knows when someone's bullshitting, if it goes on that long and that far. So I think if people really desire to have a simpler lifestyle and really do good on the planet and get part of it instead of just want to eat a piece of it, that shows through, regardless of certain things that to someone who's not really well-versed in sustainability might go, "Well, you fraud. You know, how could you possibly do this, that, and the other?" I think there needs to be some tolerance and some common sense and some, you know, understanding about that being sustainable in today's world and still being a part of the world to try to make a change requires that people use this telephone that I'm talking to you on right now. And I found with some people, and that number is shrinking, there's been in the past more less tolerance for using even modern stuff, for lack of a better term, because of some of the hardcore primitives, those people I know. "How dare you wear clothing when you could be wearing buckskin?" Well, you know, to each their own.
And you bring up a point about judgment, because one of the things that I try really hard to work on is to know better is to do better. Well, that's for my walk. And off air, I talked to you about the concert I went to in L.A. when James Taylor had a water bottle. And I figure he's, from the 60s, and how many people there at the Hollywood Bowl had water bottles. And I have to be careful about judgment and be more about solution and, like you said, be true to your own self intention and work on that. And what can I do about it? It's one of the things that happens to be a hot button for me, because I think they're creating a lot of problems for our planet. But you remind me to take a breath, to go deeper, and to not be so easy to judge, and go more to what can I do to make a difference. Okay, what about are there, in your opinion, some more pressing issues that you have focused on in the past 25 years? For example, are you more concerned now about water than you were 25 years ago? Or was it always something that you saw coming? Water shortages. There's going to be, there were droughts in 2,300 counties around the country this year in 2013. Do you see water? Do you see, I understand about your truck. I mean, we have a Suburban, and I hate it when we drive it up to the White Mountains, but we can't drive our low car that's going to get wrecked on some of the back roads. So, I mean, there's a balance. So what do you feel that there are some more pressing issues that we face as a global community that we could focus on in a positive way with the intention of changing them?
Well, you mentioned water, and ironically, from what you just said, I remember, I was a little boy or, whatever, in the elementary school years. And I remember walking by a pop machine, wherever I was living at the time, and thinking, I wonder if someday there'll be water machines. And when that day comes, we're going to be really fucked. Pardon my language. And then several years later, we were all bending over, right? Because there's the water machine, and I'm not making up this answer I just gave you based on the question you just gave me, that this is a literal thing. And so then we have the bigger problem of, am I concerned about water? Hell yes, I'm concerned about water. I mean, we're in the middle of an epic drought here in the Southwest. They're closing the forest down to fire making. They might close the forest if we don't get our monsoon season. The water tables are shrinking, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not a doom and gloom guy. I'm all about results, and the glass is half full. When I see this going on, and when I see still that it's illegal to catch rainwater in Colorado, really?
Really?
I mean, we can smoke pot and get stoned all day long and eat cookies, but we can't catch the rain that falls on a roof. There's some things that need to happen in the political arena, in local, state, and federal governments to encourage, not maybe mandate. Again, that's your motto. I heard a little song when we came on. You encourage somehow, with a tax rebate or whatever, people to start reusing and recycling water. The fact that I had a physician from Ohio come on a course of mine, years ago, probably 15 years ago. He's from Ohio, and he's a doctor. He's a smart man. And he came to Arizona for the first time, and he was driving around town before he went to my school, and he was realizing, Cody, no one here catches rain. In my community in Ohio, the entire neighborhood catches rain off the roof, off asphalt shingles, no less, and into big cisterns that are in the backyards, surrounded by shrubbery to keep them camouflaged and all nice and pretty. And he was floored that when he came to the desert, people weren't catching rainwater. And I was just as floored.
Like every precious drop we should be trying to figure out how to catch.
Every drop. And with that, that's just common sense to me. But, we don't even want to get into overconsumption of water. Clearly that's going on. But the whole thing is, if you're going to allow people to vomit out water at any point in time with an extremely subsidized low water bill that doesn't reflect, like gasoline, the real cost of the product, you should offer them some sort of conservation tips with real value, not some bullshit flyer in the mail, along with your next water bill about how to conserve and do xeriscape gardening. And that's all well and good, but, you know, there'd be a lot more money saved by putting some subsidies out for conservation than the ass-kicking we're going to take, you know, if this keeps going on. We are not sustainable. We clearly have a drought culture going on, and it's not just in the Southwest. And does that concern me? Hell yes, it concerns me, because without water, everything dies. Not just people, everything. So I've been pretty passionate about that and my water use here at my homestead, and I always will be, because I think it's the right and respectful thing to do, not just as a desert dweller, but as a freaking human being that requires that to live on a basic cellular level.
And how does the, you know, I had Robert Glennon on, who's a water expert. He's at the U of A, and he always talks about the price of water. And as long as people think it's free, basically, it is. There's not a consciousness of it, of wasting it, saving it, using it. You just turn it on. That's all. You flush the toilet, you take a shower, you use it for your cooking. And until something changes, and this is kind of a complicated question that I haven't asked anybody, so this is your shot, Cody. In restructuring that, how do we take care of the lower socioeconomic bracket? It, you know, I have a background in social services, so I always think if we raise the price of water a lot, so all of the people that can afford it will start conserving it because they don't like that their water bill get up. How do we do the balance for people that can barely pay their water bill, even if it's $19? Does that question make sense, and is that fair to ask you?
Yeah, well, we don't raise the bill a lot. We raise the education
a lot. Okay, I agree.
And that's what's not happening.
Yep.
And that's what can happen. And that's what I said. It's one thing to have a little brochure about how to xeriscape garden in your yard in the Southwest to save water. It's another thing for these municipalities and federal grant subsidies or whatever to head off this crisis of water and realize, do we really need this subdivision? And I'm not anti-growth. I'm anti-dumbass growth.
Mm-hmm.
What we're doing in good old boy Prescott is we have people apparently in power who need to go on a desert survival course and get their asses kicked about what it's like to not have water. Because I know we need growth. I know we need jobs. I know we need all that. But without water, we kind of all die, and the property values go down. So there needs to be this balance, and I don't see it happening. Prescott used to have gray water rules that finally came into effect several years ago, and guess what? Now it's illegal again. And I'm wondering, who the hell is in charge of this van that's going off the side of the mountain? So I think education, I've seen that. I'm a teacher, and you know that. So I've been teaching for many, many, many years, survival skills. But what I think might set me apart, maybe even philosophically or practically or whatever, is my biggest passion is not really outdoor survival skills. It's the survival of our species.
Yes.
And I realize a lot of people don't go outdoors in their head. In other words, they don't think outdoor survival skills are important because they don't go camping or hiking. Well, my clients, they get an earful from me because the skills I teach them are directly applicable to the backyard in a grid down scenario, or how to use less resources, how to have lower utility bills, etc. So I try to bridge this gap from this outdoor survival skills genre of catching rats with your hair to make it real practical for everyday people to use some of these skills so it doesn't become a survival situation for all of us. Because if we don't do something, if we're not conscious in our use, in our thought process, etc., we will turn this place being our planet, into a survival situation. And you can smell it. You can feel it. You know, there's all these people that are discontented. The preppy movement's way up. We could talk for hours about that, the pros and cons. The zombie movies are even more popular than ever. You know, so clearly people are concerned, but there's kind of like a warlike knee-jerk reaction mentality, a fear-based, unfortunately, mentality to preparedness. That's bullshit.
And I agree.
You know, my grandparents weren't scared.
No.
My grandparents weren't scared of being prepared. It was common sense. It's what you did. So the other thing I battle in my position as a survival instructor is to try to get away from the fear that's out there from so many other people, products, etc., that then muddy the water about what true self-reliance is
okay.
and the confidence it can bring.
We got to take a short break, and when you come back, let's talk a little bit about when all hell breaks loose and what we can do about it, and go to the micro of what happens with an experience with Cody Lundeen. Everybody, stay here with us.
Think blue. Think beyond green. Think TDI clean diesel technology. One part of the Volkswagen Think Blue initiative, our goal of creating and encouraging eco-conscious products and behaviors. This is Mrs. Green. A car that can drive a long way should still make you want to, well, drive a long way. Volkswagen Jetta's TDI clean diesel is a high-mileage vehicle that lets you stop at the filling station less often so you can spend more time enjoying the road. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI.
Bookman Sports Exchange is now open at 3330 East Speedway. We're taking our passion and experience of buying, selling, and trading books and music and applying it to the world of sporting goods, outdoor, and fitness gear. We are giving you another way to save money on the things that you love, Bookman style. Remember, Bookman Sports Exchange, sporting goods, outdoor, and fitness gear, now open daily from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. on Speedway east of Country Club. Check out bookmans.com for more info.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. If you're just joining us, our extremely knowledgeable and, I would add, courageous guest today is Cody Lundeen. Cody is an internationally recognized professional survival instructor with more than 25 years of hands-on teaching experience in survival skills. Among his many accomplishments, in 1991, he actually founded the Aboriginal Living Skills School using the same passion, determination, and psychological stamina he used to overcome when overcoming some personal challenges and healing his life. I do want to add again that he is the best-selling author of two books on survival and preparedness, 98.6 Degrees, The Art of Keeping Your Ass Alive, and When All Hell Breaks Loose, Stuff You Need to Survive When Disaster Strikes, which was published in 2006. And Cody, I really am hard-pressed to think of anybody that I've had on the show that's actually, that's done what you've done and done as much of it. I've watched some of your shows, and I just, like, I can't even breathe. I never stop to go to the bathroom until there's a commercial. Because, and then when Mort King told me about what it was like, and, you know, I'd like to talk about that for a little bit, because I don't think I'm one of those hypocritical greenies. You know, we've made major changes in our life. I live to make more. We're doing things. There are things that I'm not happy about. We don't have solar panels yet. Our water bill is minimal because we have xeriscaping. But doing what you do is so important, of going out and teaching people to live in nature, in I would say, an extreme, like, not a lot of water bottles. You need to tell us about that. And the appreciation with which they leave about nature and the earth. Can you talk a little bit about what this school is and what happens?
Yeah. As you said, I founded the Aboriginal Living Skills School in 1991. And as far as what a client gets, and like I mentioned earlier, the genre of self-reliant skills that I teach, and they get muddied and confused and all BS'd up by the media, are outdoor survival skills, primitive living skills, urban preparedness, and a little bit of homesteading. And those are all separate subcategories that if a client came to me and wanted to train, like they wanted to go fishing and camping in the mountains with the Jeep, and they wanted to know what to do if the vehicle broke down, I pushed them into a modern survival course,
Okay. Not
a permanent course. So these are all separate intentions. They're all trees in the forest, but all the trees are different types of trees, and you need to know the difference. Some you can build your house with, some you can make fire out of, some you can, you know, whatever. I mean, all trees are not the same
right. When
you get to it. As far as what a client gets after an experience with my school, you know, I've had, of course, some wonderful feedback over the years a lot of it is very personal to that client. The more aggressive courses that I do, I actually warn them after the course is over to be careful about what they tell and who they tell, especially right after the experience, because it's so kind of a blow-open experience that they leave altered, literally. I've had clients come on a course after a nasty divorce. You know, I've had clients come on a course, and when they got back, they went and proceeded with a divorce, or they went and proceeded and got married, or they made these major life decisions based on her, based on being out in nature and being blown open to, again, what is really needed as opposed to what is really wanted, and they're vastly different. So what I hope a client gets, and it's usually par for the course, so to speak, is a greater self-awareness and a greater confidence, a greater self-reliance. Well, we have a lot of fun, even to the misery, on some of the courses, and a lot of the most potent changes and transformations I see in my clientele come from the really shitty times we can have in the field, a really aggressive, you're walking, the blister's as big as a quarter, you haven't eaten, it's really hot, because when they come back to town, their gratitude level goes through the roof, and they realize, wow, I've got it made here. And as I've had many, many, many people come back to tell me that they literally are more conscious of their resource use from taking an outdoor survival skills course, let alone some of the other stuff I do. Because when you realize who survives and who doesn't, and look back to revolutionary time, it really was a calorie game, and about conserving calories and trying to minimize movement due to the expenditure of calories and water, which can be hard to come by in the field. They really get it viscerally about conservation. And that conservation mindset spills through into their everyday life, which I told you earlier is what I really want. I want to attack head-on the bullshit that happens in our urban and rural communities, not so much just the outdoors and the woods. Nature's fine. You know, we lose people to outdoor survival all the time. Hopefully that can minimize more. But really the biggest cause of survival that I see happening to our planet is us, and it's us in mass, in our cities and bigger towns, etc., you know, wherever there's more people, we're using more stuff. And if I could, you know, wrap my head around those people and take them out for an experience, I think we'd use less stuff, and we'd be happier doing it. This isn't some austere bullshit, right? Oh, I got to do more with less and suffer and lay in the dirt and not take a shower but once a month. And yeah, you can do that if you want to, but I'm calling you from a thermoregulated place. It heats and cools itself. It's beautiful. There's lots of colors. I can watch movies when I want, microwave, whatever I want to do, whatever my needs are or my wants are, and I'm in the middle of freaking nowhere out here. So you can get needs and wants met in a more sustainable way, and I think that part of the challenge in marketing, for lack of a better term, an eco lifestyle, is in telling people, literally, if I can make you more comfortable and save you money, would you be interested in what I have to say? And unanimously, you hear a big hell yes.
And it's all in the messaging of that. I mean, it's profoundly different. It's just not like going out on a 3-day wilderness experience at all. I mean, it's wilderness living and translating that back to the world. What do you do in, you know, one of the things that I read, I believe, is it was about disaster mitigation, you know, training and survival of that. And what interested me when I saw that is we have had so many national disasters in our country this past year. I mean, they continue to happen, whether it's snow or floods or droughts. I mean, what are some of the things that you're trying to teach people in a course that's designed to do that?
To teach people to be more self-reliant. And I know I'm being redundant, but I didn't just come back. But the last keynote I gave was a few months ago, and it was to the National Safety Conference, believe it or not, Safety and Health Conference in New York State. It's the oldest safety and health conference in the nation. and I got the big tour of the Love Canal. Okay, this is where it's happening, right? For just a few decades ago, we completely crapped all over the landscape there. And because this is a heavy industrialized area near Niagara Falls, that's why the state government got together and said, we have people dying here. Not just of radiation, but I mean, it was such an aggressive industrial town that they, it's over 100 years old. And they made this safety and health conference, and they had me keynote it this year. And I talked with the guy that hired me for that. And, we talked. He wanted, of course, more outdoor survival stuff because of the TV show or whatnot. And I tried to convince him with little effort, why don't we do it about the home? Every one of your people coming to this conference, they may hunt, they may fish, they may whatever, but they all go back to an urban or suburban environment.
Right.
And they're in that home, or they all go to work downtown, and they're subjected to these potential causal effects of that flood or earthquake or snowstorm or whatever. And ironically, while I'm giving the lecture, there's a massive blizzard that's hitting where I'm giving the lecture, and I couldn't fly out that night because they closed the whole place down because of the snowstorm. So it couldn't get much more tangible while I'm delivering this home preparation thing for whatever natural disasters or weather epic events that's actually happening. Of course, Buffalo, New York is so kick-ass with their snow removal. They have a PhD in snow removal.
Really?
We left the next morning. If that had happened in Phoenix, Arizona, I'd still be in Niagara Falls, New York.
You definitely would.
What I'm getting at is it's about the home. And what I'm trying to do is everyone has a home, usually, or at least part-time that they go to. And I'm trying to take the biggest chunk out of the pie that I can. And that's the average American, in this case, because we're in the U.S., that's in that suburban and urban environment with an on-the-grid home that's a ticking time bomb if anything happens, from ice taking down the power lines, whatever. And like you said, how many times have we seen this go down in this last winter season? I mean, the East Coast got pummeled again and again and again, and people were without power for days, and there was hundreds of thousands of people without power. And I got many emails because of that book, When All Hell Breaks Loose, saying, hey, thanks a lot, because we're not in crisis mode, because we read your book a year or two
and
ago.
Got ready.
Yeah, we got all the stuff, and it's not fear-based. It's just a big duh. It's just big common sense. And so, again, it's the unfortunate thing about a lot of Americans is they only think about toilet paper when they're down to their last roll. And that can be a really shitty experience, if you know what I'm saying.
That's so true, and boy, did you hit one for me. But I want to comment that in hopefully the adequate and many hours I did in preparing for this interview out of respect for your time, nothing about your website, your clips, your being filmed on camera, to me, evokes fear. It's all about being prepared, being real, getting ready. I would say I'm rather a scaredy cat when it comes to these things. And what I read and hear is, don't be scared, be prepared. And I think that that's really coming through in this interview. It's not a fear-based message that you send, which some of the more glamorous Hollywood hype, as you say, BS shows are. It's doomsday and, the walking dead and eating each other. And that's, you're so polar to that. You're the antithesis of, you're imagining a world of surviving, doing with less, and thriving. Is that fair?
Well, yeah, that's because I actually do what I do. And I'm not an actor, and I'm not some producer who doesn't even go outside, let alone do out survival skills. I'm not a network that doesn't give a shit about quality, that only cares about ratings. So, yeah, whenever you add the media to something that must have integrity, because we're dealing with people's lives here, all hell can break loose. So, thanks for noticing.
No, it's true. It's like, this is the voice of calm. If anything happens, you're the person I want to be standing next to, you and my husband, because he just, you know, he's one of the people that everybody's going to want around because he knows how to do things. He knows how to do things with his hands and with nature and how to cut and make knots and all of those things that are really going to matter. I'm going to ask you really, it's coming from out of nowhere, but what is your... you know, do you have a strong opinion about the amount of meat we're consuming as a planet? Because I'll be honest and upfront, it concerns me. The methane gas, the water that's used, the treatment of the animals. In my 6 years as Mrs. Green, we have started eating less and less and less meat and gone to a plant-based diet. We do eat meat. But that is a big concern. And I'd love to know what you think about, is it something that we should keep an eye on? Lots of cows, lots of methane, lots of water.
Yeah, I used to be a vegetarian, believe it or not, and now I eat tons of meat. So I'm going to disappoint you with that one.
No, there's no disappointing. There's just an honest answer.
do I think it's a concern? Yeah, I think factory farming is a concern. What I would like to get into out here, but it was hard to do that because I've been so busy the last several years, is I already have the chicken coop built. I have a passive solar designed ferro cement chicken coop that I've built with students over a few courses out here from the colleges, but it's never seen a chicken because you can't feed a chicken when you're in Bolivia, you know. So, and I also would like to get into aquaculture. So I eat a lot of meat because I train. I love to weight lift, and so I break down my body on a regular basis, and I do consume more than average protein to build that back up. But I would like to get more into food. And that's my missing link out here, just because of time factor and travel, really, more than anything else. So what I'm doing is building infrastructure and doing research and dialing that in, and then I'll get the product. In other words, I have a wonderful guy I know who is the head of the they have an amazing greenhouse out by college, and they grow tilapia and trout
right. And
hydroponic tomatoes. Just amazing, amazing man. He's like a walking dictionary. And he said, Cody, I got your tilapia whenever you're ready. You know, so I'm heavily connected with people that are walking the walk as far as food production. And that's my missing link. Not that I didn't garden for well over a decade. I was a gardening fool when I had the time to do that. But I do eat lots of meat, and I would rather not, but for my lifestyle, I feel better when I do it, and I've tried it both ways. But I would like to start raising what I kill. I think a lot of people would be vegetarians if they had to slaughter what they ate.
And true.
Yeah, it's never been more
true.
Fun than that.
I'd be one of those. Oh, my gosh. Well, it's interesting to me, too, because you're right about not everybody has the lifestyle that lends itself to growing their own. One of the most encouraging things to me is the growth of chicken coops. Like in Tucson, we have chicken coop tours, and families are growing it. They're using the eggs. There's also an overabundance of chickens showing up at the Humane Society because the chickens grow up and they stop laying eggs, and then people do not want to kill them. So guess where they're taking them? So we have an abundance of chickens at the Humane Society. And I think your point is, yeah, I love those eggs, and it was really great, but I can't wring its neck and eat it. So that's another piece that I think we have to be aware of. And growing your own food, it's a very positive thing that I see everywhere that I go around the country. More people are growing in smaller spaces. Schools are growing food. Not very encouraging when you see a movie like Fed Up, but we have to have hope, and there's got to be hope about that. Well, we have to take another break, but when we come back, I would love for you to talk a little bit about your homestead, how you're using it, what kinds of people are using it, and what they're learning from that. More about the you know, the practical application and little steps that people can do and using it as an educational forum, and then anything else that you want to talk about. I want to ask you what scared you the most in your life, too, so get ready for that one, okay? Like, has Cody Lundeen ever been scared? It's like, what's the big question that's kind of goofy, but that I know that I can ask him? So we're going to take a short break, everybody. If you've just joined us, we are just having a ball. I know I am. I'm interviewing Cody Lundeen. He's an internationally recognized professional survival instructor with more than 25 years of hands-on teaching experience. He loves nature. He has a school called the Aboriginal Living Skills School, using his passion and his commitment to Mother Earth to help people learn about all kinds of things when it comes to survival. Please stay here with us. We'll be right back.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 and Glimmerglass Radio Networks. If you have questions about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green with some pretty impressive news about the VW Jetta TDI. It's got a turbocharged clean diesel engine. It's 90% cleaner than previous diesel engines. It gets 609 miles on one tank of gas, more than the Prius. That's from Tucson, Arizona to San Diego and halfway back. And it's got an amazing 6-speed Tiptronic transmission. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI or visit ChapmanTucson.com.
You already know the Habit Store has cabinets, appliances, and paint, but did you know that we have contemporary and vintage furnishings? You might find a gorgeous new sofa offered at 50% off retail price or an antique mahogany dresser priced to sell. You might also find some great weekly specials on the Red Tag Sale. Keep up with the bargains through Facebook, Twitter, and our monthly newsletter. The Habit Store hours are Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, Saturdays, 8 to 4, and you'll find us on Grant Road, just off I-10 in Tucson, Arizona.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to, and we're certainly giving all of us, myself included, a lot to think about today because of our great guest. His name is Cody Lundeen. He's an internationally recognized professional survival instructor with more than 25 years of hands-on teaching experience, and I repeat that because he was doing it way, way, way before I woke up to doing things like this. His love of all things actually started as a child with the influence of his homesteading grandparents. He has written two best-selling books, 98.6 Degree, The Art of Keeping Your Ass Alive, and When All Hell Breaks Loose, Stuff You Need to Survive When Disaster Strikes in 2006. And if you just joined us, Cody said that with the disasters that happened on the East Coast this past winter, of which there were many, of which several of my friends were definitely impacted, I think we should all think about getting that book and writing a review on Amazon, because it's preparedness that helps assuage the fear and prevent the fear when disaster strikes. I think we're going to have pretty hot, dry summer. I'm worried about the forest fires. Cody Lundeen, thanks for what you do for the planet, and thanks for being on my show.
Well, thanks for the invite.
Okay, let's talk about the how you're using the homestead. Is it a training opportunity? Do you let people use it when you travel? Tell us a little bit about that whole construct.
Sure. First off, my homestead is my home, so there's not like mini tours set up at the corner with a little golf cart that goes around. You know. But that said, I do have students out here, mostly through sustainable design classes. I've been working with a COSA Institute, highly recommended on sustainable design, since their inception in 2000. And what I do is take their kids out and basically rough them up in the woods to show them what baseline sustainability is really about before they go back to the drawing table, and I mean that literally, because it's an architecture school. It's about people who will be building, quote-unquote, green buildings for the rest of their life to influence our culture and others. And so I have nature trash them for 3 days and have them pig pile and have them cuddle with someone they've never met because they're freezing their ass off at night, and limit their food and et cetera, and show them what baseline sustainability really is. And I hope that that influences their design work. So I'll have those type of students out here as well. And they've done many things at the homestead, from help build a raised garden to the chicken coop I was referring to a little bit ago, to all sorts of little projects, hands-on, that when I've had the time, I've had many, many tribes of students out to try to do some hands-on work that matters, you know, to get them dirty, because they love to get dirty and realize, wow, you know, this is what it's like to lift this rock. Because you can draw a line on a piece of paper and have some other poor schmuck move the rock or the lumber, but unless you really get dirty and use your body and feel what it's like to build sustainably or build at all, it's kind of they're missing something. So they come out here and use the homestead as a training arena for that. Other people come in a controlled setting just for a tour, like it's part of a course per se, or some of the colleges I work with. So it does get a lot of use, albeit under my discretion, for trying to be an inspirational place. It's a living lab, you know. I mean, I'm living out here. So it's not a theory. It's not a cool blog post. It's, wow, this is what one dude's doing to live out in the high desert, and it's pretty nice out here. It's pretty comfortable out here. And so that is a big side effect from living this way and living out here and being able to share those energies and ideas and inspirations with other people.
What's the two questions I have? What is the ratio of women to men, and do you think that matters? I mean, is it more guys like to do it? And I'm not asking that in any, you know, I'm not trying to be biased, but is it, you know, to me, my husband's a lot stronger than I am. He can lift heavier rocks. On the other hand, I have women in one of my networking groups, and she's the fire chief for the Northwest Fire District, and she could just back kick anybody's butt. So who's coming?
For which? There's many different courses I do.
Like just for the architecture school, where you said you're taking them out there and you throw them out in nature for 3 days and show them what it's like. Are you seeing more women do that? I mean, typically that's been a male-dominated field traditionally in just regular architecture.
Well, for ACOSA, for the ACOSA Institute, it's not down the middle by any stretch, but there's a lot of women that take that course. I had one tribe. There was like two guys and 12 women, believe it or not. And we were doing handbell fire out in the desert. And those guys felt like they'd died and gone to heaven, you know, being surrounded by a tribe of Amazon women, you know. So ACOSA can get heavily skewed more toward the feminine than the masculine. But usually it's 60-40, swinging either way. There's usually an ample number of women and men that take that sustainable design course or architecture course. It's really usually a really nice blend.
And what are the things that are, like, is there something at which point you can usually predict this is going to be the hardest for them? For example, they don't have any water, or they couldn't find food, or they're freezing to death. Is there one thing, or is it the culmination of the experience that really gets to people and gets them over the hump or to the other side, because they survived it, they did it?
For Aboriginal Living Skills School students or ACOSA students?
For ACOSA students.
Well, ACOSA don't know I'm coming, you know, so they didn't sign up for me. They signed up to sit in a lab and take a design course. They didn't expect some freaky dude to be trashing them out in the woods. And that's what Tony Brown, who founded ACOSA, loves about me stepping in, because I shock the troops. That's my job, is to shock the troops. And he also loves me stepping in because I don't just know about outdoor survival skills and primitive living skills. I've built my homestead, you know, of course, with the help of many others. I'm actually living this way and have created a lifestyle, so I get the added benefit of being able to indoctrinate the students that they can do this, that if they want to do it for real, they better damn get serious about it and consider it a business. They need to make an income, or they're going to be giving me extra fire sauce at Taco Bell. You know, so they need to take it seriously and treat it as a commodity, and I'm pretty big on that if people want to make a living at their lifestyle passion, because too many times have I seen younger people and older people get beaten down by the BS in society or negativity from someone else that, oh, you'll never do that. Why don't you get a real job? I heard that for years when I was growing up. And thank God I'm stubborn and don't give a shit about what most people think about me. So I try to indoctrinate these young, usually young, although I've seen 55, 60-year-old students
right.
in the Costa, for example, and with my own courses, that they can do this, but they need to take life by the balls and do it in a way that does make a profit margin. There's nothing wrong with making money.
Right.
I used to think there was an issue with making money, and that's why I was broke. And I went to an expensive college for other people. I got there on a full Pell Grant, and I laid carpet for the book lady, and I lived in the woods in a brush shelter. And when the financial aid person would raise it $1,000 for everyone else, he'd raise it $100 for me, wink, wink, nod, nod.
Right.
Because he knew I was having a hard time. And I was on food stamps for part of that time. So I know from what I speak. And as far as smashing limitations, I found the most limiting people have, the most limiting concepts they have, comes right between their own 2 ears. And so I try to smash those limitations and yet ground it in the reality of, yep, it's going to be a hell of a lot of work. And you're going to need to work your butt off, more than likely like I have, to get those clients happy. And when your clients, which is your best form of marketing, go, wow, we walked into our new house and it's 70 degrees and it's 20 degrees outside and we don't even need to burn wood, then they're going to have the world by the tail. And so part of my job at ACOSA and with my own students at ALSS is to inspire people to want to make a life change and to want to have the enthusiasm and passion that's needed to drive a wedge through this self-limiting crap that we're surrounded with, you know, by this industrial consumerism culture, as wonderful as it is. It tends to make people stoop over forward with a heavy weight of responsibility and debt and bills that I would like to throw off them and free them of that, if at all possible. Because one cannot be sustainable and self-reliant under loads and loads and loads of debt.
Right. And the also, you know, you factor in there the health piece of it, which is so looming large for us. It's all, to me, one big ball of wax inherent in, you know, there's a diagnosis now called nature deficit disorder for kids because they're inside and they're on their gizmos and they have no clue about what to do when they are put outside. My grandchildren not included, I might add. Their mother is committed to having them live an outdoor experience as much as they possibly can, and they're some tough little cookies, and I love it. So it's that part of it, too. This is one of those questions that I said, okay, I'm going to ask them. I'm not going to ask them. I'm going to ask them. I'm not going to ask them, because it's almost cliche, but I didn't hear anybody else ask it on the things that I listen to. Were you ever afraid for your life? Were you ever so scared in a situation that you thought, I'm just going to say it, oh shit, here it is. I'm going to bite the big one?
In the outdoors? Or
in the outdoors. I was going to say, yeah, maybe in college you were scared, more scared in the city. But in the outdoors, was there ever that moment when there was something that you said, I'm really going to have to figure out how to get out of this one to survive?
That is true for a course I had. I believe it was in 1993 or 94. I had a course where I had a lot of students at a college get sick. And it was something we ate, and I was sick too. And I had to hike out using the North Star along with a person who's a student who's still, now he's been a co-instructor for me every once in a while. He still even speaks to me. And I was vomiting myself. And it turned into a helicopter rescue that was pretty major. And I had people who I thought were going to die. They were on the ground, crapping their pants because they didn't have the energy to pull down their pants, and vomiting at the same time.
Wow.
So they were dehydrating out at a frightening rate at God knows what time in the middle of the night. This is on a primitive skills course.
Right.
So no modern gear, gourd canteens, a wool blanket, a cattail sleeping mat, etc. So that was the time that I was the most scared and realized if I kill one of my students, I would have quit. I would have done something else, and we wouldn't have been having this conversation in the context we're having it.
I'm so glad I did ask the question. And why am I not surprised that you had a much deeper answer? I mean, it's a glorious and authentic answer, and I thank you for sharing that with me. And that was 93, and it never happened again. We're at 2014.
Oh, yeah, it happened again.
Did you have a plan B?
not that hardcore. There was no rescue or whatever, but when you push the envelope like I do, sometimes you break through. And most people just get sick because of exertion and whatever. But that happened one more time, not nearly as bad. But we got ourselves, and this is again, still way back in the early years, the early 90s. We're doing some pretty rough stuff out in the field. And, you know, I don't want to say SIJT happens, but it does. You know, and so people should realize, and I don't, what a great way not to market my courses, right? But people should realize, and this isn't a caveat for someone being sloppy or dangerous in their instruction, that a lot of people, you know, they see something in a magazine or TV or a movie, and, wow, that's cool. You know, let's do that. And they don't realize it's produced. And when they actually get out in the field and face it for real, I just got off a course 2 days ago, Sunday. It ended called the Nothing Course. And true to its name, we take almost nothing with us. And while it's only a two-day course, I had some people in that experience that had some preconceived notions about what living off the land was, and those get smashed pretty quickly, especially here in the Southwest. And again, that influences a preparedness plan, and that influences their thought process, and that influences who they are as people. And I think that's a good thing. I think reality, I think sanity, I think common sense and groundedness, I think that's a good thing. If you have people that deal with other people's lives, like the survival skills profession, that don't think that way, then you should run like hell.
Right. And it's part of a community. I mean, to me, it's so translatable. It's more than just getting through a ropes course together. It's like, yeah, this is about survival. And is there in the Nothing Course, can you just survive on your own, or is part of it, I really literally do know nothing about the intricate details, is it one of the tenets that you have to rely on each other for survival? Is that part of the core philosophy, help each other?
Or That's a great question. It's funny you say that, because I had a lot of individualists, and there was some preppers, quote-unquote, self-described preppers there, that are individualists, right? And they were going to do this all on their own. And everything in the Nothing Course, and in courses of mine in general, is based on the tribe. And you're talking
awesome.
To pretty much an introvert. But it can't go that way. The average age of a mountain man or woman before they were dead was about 34 to 37 years old. They died young. Why? Because they were doing everything alone. And they had a gun and a horse and a mule and a bag of flour and, frankly, a wilderness landscape where it wasn't all poached out at this point in time. And they still died young. So absolutely, it's a tribal affair. And it is on the entire planet. And I use that metaphor with, we can't just be green in Chicago and not green in San Diego. It needs to be a combined effort, a one-two punch by not just the U.S., but other nations to help get our shit together on this planet so that we can have other people, like children and grandchildren, that have something to eat, air to breathe, and a life.
Cody, what a way to end the show. That can be your final statement, except for we have to, that the show has to be over, and to me it flew. And I just want to tell everybody that for the first time this year, we're doing a best of show on July 5th, featuring Gary Oppenheimer from Ample Harvest, his national network and working concept for getting free food to people and families that will need it, will inspire you and delight you. It's again, a tribal concept. So Cody, you get the last word, CodyLundeen.com. Tell us one thing to start thinking about, one call to action that you would say to our listeners and to the people that will listen to this podcast, because there are thousands of them.
Follow your heart always and be realistic about what you plan to do now and in the future.
Oh my gosh, what a great guest. Thank you for showing up on the planet and in my life. Everybody make it a great, green, intentionally lived, sustainable week. This is Mrs. Green.